Will we see Joey and Billy next week?
I'm sorry.
Will we see Joey and Billy next week?
I don't know if Billy will be home next weekend, but Joey will be home today. She was on a cruise and she got back yesterday. But Billy has to wear safety glasses because he really can't see. So he had safety glasses made and she had to take his safety glasses.
Well, tell them we miss them. Bob Davis didn't stay. I didn't get a chance to talk. I didn't get a chance to talk to him. We are in 1 Timothy. And we have seen that right out of the chute, the first task that Timothy has to do, taking over for the Apostle Paul, is to confront some false teachers that are going on. What I find interesting, if Paul was there, how did these false teachers creep up in his presence? Not unless there was a gap of time between when Paul was there and Timothy. I'm not sure. But it's always a constant struggle. And for young Timothy, who we said is young and introverted and frail, to have the first thing to do when he gets there to confront and correct some false teachers, that's stout. Stuff. It may lead even to a church split. And all of that is very unpleasant, and very unpleasant for a man of Timothy's temperament. But false teaching is bad news, literally. So in verses 4b through 17, Timothy is to correct these false teachers, and Paul gives three reasons why these false teachers need to be confronted. So before he sets up leadership, before he sets up the parameters of the worship service, leadership being in chapter 3 of 1 Timothy and worship being in chapter 2, he deals with these false teachers in chapter 1. So he deals with the problem before he gets on to the positive construction. The first reason is given that false teaching does not produce godly behavior. We saw that in verses 4b through 6. He says about these, the false teachers promote the trivial rather than an obedience inspired by faith. We saw that the last part of verse 4, he said that these false teachers promote speculations rather than the stewardship from God that is by faith. They're teaching inferences upon inferences. We think that they're making up stuff, myths and endless genealogies that are really nowhere. Then he says that false teaching does not achieve the true goals of Christian doctrine, which is love for God and man, from a pure heart, a clean conscience, and a sincere faith. Verse 5, we said that a ministry must have a clear aim and must always stick to that aim. And if they have to change the aim, they better do so because they have clear and overwhelming evidence that it needs to be changed based on a deeper knowledge of the Word of God. Not because culture is changing. Biblical truth is not determined by a congregational vote. Verse 6, that false teachers, having missed the true goal, teach trivialities. They just go off into vain discussion. He's mentioned that before, but that brings up the point. A vain meaning futile. It doesn't produce the proper, okay, you got all this information, so what? I must never forget when I'm teaching the Word of God, that it is imperative for me to answer the question that is invisibly hanging around the neck of each one of you, and that is, so what? You know, I teach the doctrine of the Trinity. Okay, so what? What difference does it make? How does it affect the Christian faith? How does it affect how I live? How does this apply? Why should I believe it? And I think I've quoted to you Luther, who said that if you try to understand the doctrine of the Trinity, you'll lose your mind. If you don't believe it, you lose your soul. It is a doctrine that we must accept by faith. I think it was the neo-Orthodox Reinhold Niebuhr, who doesn't believe in the inspiration or inerrancy of Scripture, but he said of all the doctrines taught in the Bible, the one that is most empirically proven, the one doctrine in the Bible for which there is a mountain of evidence found in everyday life, is the doctrine of original sin. And our society is bent on denying it. Okay? They like to think that man is born pure. He's not. Okay, so the first reason why Timothy is to correct these false teachers is because it doesn't produce godly behavior. And that is key. At the end of the day, as J. Vernon McGee, how many of you ever heard J. Vernon McGee? John Vernon McGee. You like him? My mom and dad loved him. That's exactly what he would say. That's exactly where I was going, Jerry. Where the rubber meets the road. That's exactly. Now, the second reason is found in verses 7 through 11. The second reason Timothy is to do this because false teaching does not produce godly behavior. But secondly, false teachers, now identified as teachers of the law, make four crucial mistakes in how they handle the law of Moses. Mistake number one is in verse 17. These false teachers, while appearing knowledgeable, are personally ignorant about the law of Moses. They desire, here's the problem. Verse 7, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, desiring to be teachers of the law. Remember what James says in chapter 3 about be careful of desiring to be a teacher because you get a stricter judgment. Here it comes. But he says that without understanding either what they are saying or the things about which they make confident assertion. So they are ignorant and yet very cocky about it, very assured of it. That's a deadly combination. All education, I bet Red will agree with me on this one, all education begins with moving from unconscious ignorance to conscious ignorance. From I don't know, and I don't know that I don't know, to I don't know, but I know that I don't know. Some of the biggest problems I've had with some of the saints in my years of ministry is that they don't know, and they don't know that they don't know, but they're very confident that they're right. And they don't listen to anybody else except their own selves. Anyone here bought one of your favorite Canadians, Jordan Peterson? You don't know that name. He is the one that's leading the one-man fight against the entire Canadian government, where you are mandated by law to refer to a transgender person or anybody by the pronoun that they... Jordan Peterson, a teacher. He wrote a book called 12 Rules for Living. And he said, one of the things that you have to have in your toolbox in order to live life successfully is you have to come to the point where you understand that the person you're talking to knows something you don't. This is a nice way of saying you got to be teachable. In our society, we don't listen to anybody anymore. It's all arguing. Have you seen it on they're not listening to one another. They don't assume that the other side has some element of truth. It's just they're total idiots. I see this on the far left. Anybody that disagrees with them, they're homophobic. Anybody disagrees with them, they're fascist. Man, you do that kind of thinking, you've written off everybody else that disagrees with you. That is a clear claim to infallibility. And whenever you make that claim, it's just a matter of time before you make a very serious mistake. Well, that's what's going on here. They don't know that they don't understand the law, but that doesn't stop them. That doesn't stop them. So all education goes from unconscious ignorance to conscious ignorance. From I don't know and I don't know that I don't know to I don't know, but at least I know I don't know. You can't teach anything to somebody who already knows it all, right? So, I like Peterson's statement. You have to assume that somebody, Will Rogers said it best. He said, we're all ignorant, just on different subjects. That's true. G.K. Chesterton said, now that I'm on this roll, G.K. Chesterton said that there are not boring people. There are uninteresting people. They're just people who are uninterested in other people. In other words, you have to assume he knows something in some area that I don't know. And in that, he can be my teacher. So I think this goes back to teachableness, a meekness. When you have a recalcitrant student, it's very difficult. Okay, mistake number two. Mistake number one, they seem to know what they're talking about, but they really don't. Mistake number two is in verses 8 and 9a. These false teachers do not understand that the law of Moses, although it's good if properly used, is not designed to produce Christian righteousness. Look at what Paul says. Now we know that if the law is good, if one uses it lawfully. He makes the same point in Romans 7. The law is good if you use it properly. A knife is a good tool if you use it properly. A gun is a good tool if you use it properly. The tongue is a good tool if you use it properly. But to misuse any of those, and especially the law of Moses, you get into trouble. So Paul is going to defend himself with this qualification. Paul is defending himself against Jews who are saying, oh, Paul is anti-law. He's not anti-law. He said the law is good. It's perfect, holy, just, and good for what it does. And what is the purpose of the law? Let's see if anyone remembers what I said yesterday. Last week. Do. The law what? It defines sin. It tells us what sin is. I would not have known coveting unless the law says, thou shalt not covet. Oh, Well, then you mean what I've been doing is wrong. Yeah, that's right. By the way, of the Ten Commandments, they're all external, except that one. Thou shalt not murder. Oh, I can hate them. Just don't pull the trigger and shoot them. This, that, and the other thing. But coveting, that all happens right here. Yeah, right? So that's right. My hair right? Is that what? Oh, okay. I get all sorts of signs like, and then this. Yeah. The worst one is, that's when I know I've really lost it. But she keeps me, Karen, behind every successful man is a tired wife. Right? You feel her pain? Yes. Okay. Mistake number three. Here's where we pick up. These false teachers forget that the law is intended for the sinful. It doesn't teach righteousness. It is for the sinful. Look what he says in the last part of verse 9 and verse 10. But for the lawless and disobedient, for the ungodly and sinners, for the unholy and profane, for those who strike fathers and mothers, for murderers, the sexually immoral, men who practice homosexuality, enslavers, liars, perjurers, and then, in case Paul missed anything, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. Now, many people have pointed out that this list is basically a summation of the Ten Commandments. And they, lawless and disobedient, ungodly, the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, so forth. By the way, notice the relationship, lawless and disobedient. The lawless man is the guy that is so arrogant, he makes up his own rules in life. You have no truth. I only have my truth. You have your truth. This is what I believe. And only person's opinion matters is mine. That's the lawless man. He makes up his own rules. It was said about the Kennedys that that's what they played the game of politics by, their own rules. Lawless. They don't recognize the Ten Commandments. They don't recognize anything that God demands of them. But the disobedient are those who say, yeah, I know I'm not supposed to do that, but I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway. So the first one is worse than the second one. The first one says, there's no other law other than me. And the other one says, well, I know there's another law, but I'm going to go ahead and do it my way. Both of them are bad, but lawless is worse. Then you have for the ungodly and sinners. Ungodly, they don't look anything like God. They don't act like God. They don't love God. And sinners, that's their behavior. And if you notice, there's almost a cause and effect relationship there. You see the same thing in Romans 1:18. Why don't we turn there for just a second? Romans 1:18. Paul is explaining why God's judgment is coming down on people today and how he manifests it. Romans chapter 1. Verse 18, for the wrath of God. Now, when was the last time you heard a sermon on the wrath of God? I remember, I was cheeky. This is when I still had the gift of infallibility. I attended a church one night where they had a sing-spiration. Everyone had songs and everyone sang. I think the preacher wanted a night off, so he had everybody sing, and the theme was the love of God, and everybody chose hymns about the love of God. And he came to me afterwards and said, well, what did you think of our theme night? I said, great, I'm looking forward to the one when you have one on the wrath of God. And he looked at me and said, that's not funny. He didn't understand what I was trying to say, and I was probably a bit cheeky in doing it. What I was saying is that we like to select certain attributes about God, and we love those. But there are other attributes of God we don't talk about. We don't talk about. And this is the wrath of God. And our society suffers from the fact that we don't have a God of wrath. The wrath of God is revealed, present tense. And I think the chapter explains the meaning of the present tense. How does God reveal his wrath? He lets men do what they want, and he punishes people with getting the sins they want. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven, his sovereignty, against, notice this, all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Now these two in the Greek are tied very closely together. One article contains both nouns. But I want you to notice ungodliness, unrighteousness, bad attitude toward God, ungodliness, unlikeness to God, cause, effect, bad behavior, unrighteousness. What you think about God is one of the most important thoughts you will ever have. And what you think continually about God is very important. I think one of the ways in which we can overcome sin or have a greater measure of victory is to remember that God is always present. I remember it was just this past week. Yeah, I think it was this past week. Someone used profanity in my presence and said, and then he said, well, I hate to swear in front of a pastor. I said, that's okay. God hears you all the time. So you see, this peskiness that I showed when I was a kid hasn't been completely eradicated. But that's the point. Oh, I know. Yeah, it was this past week at Walgreens. She said she had some jokes, but she wouldn't want to tell them to a pastor. It's okay. God hears them anyway. If we recognize this, you get this in Matthew 6. If you do your deeds in order to, in public, to gain people's applause, you have your reward. But if you do your things privately, you will be rewarded by God. And the constant practice of the presence of God is a great deterrent to sin. It's a great deterrent to sin that he hears. When you're alone, he sees what you're watching. He knows what you're thinking. When you're with buddy and it's just you and your buddy and you can say stuff, he hears that. Once you get that grasp, that idea, that'll be a good deterrent for sin. By the way, H.G. Wells became an atheist because he absolutely detested as a teenager the idea that when he was alone in his room, God saw everything that he was doing. So our attitude towards God can determine how we behave. So the cause and effect relationship implied in 1:18 and back here about ungodly and sinners in 1 Timothy, these are very important thoughts. Tozer says in his Knowledge of the Holy, well, what comes into your mind when you think about God is the most important thought you'll ever have. By the way, I'd be interested to let you know, Karl Barth was not exactly a conservative Christian teacher, but very popular. And he came over to America, this German who lived in Switzerland, and was asked at Princeton University, you'll love this, Karen. All of these PhDs, the auditorium was full of who's who in American religious church history, right there. And they got chances to ask questions. And one man came to the microphone and said, Dr. Barth, what is the most profound thought that has ever entered your mind. This is a man who's written a bunch of books that long. Okay? He paused for a moment, and then he said, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. That's a profound answer. Now, that doesn't sound profound in the ears of the world, but that doesn't matter. Okay, he goes on, he says, unholy and profane. Profanity is using religious words in a non-religious context. I mentioned hell in my sermon. Was that profanity? No, because I was really referring to hell. But if I tell somebody else it was a hell of a good time, is that profanity? Yes. Damnation or damn, is that a biblical word? Yeah. If I say it when I take my hammer and miss one nail and hit another nail, and I say damn, is that profanity? Yep. Those who strike fathers and mothers. By the way, the Talmud said that about this, not only that they strike fathers and mothers, but one way in which you can strike fathers and mothers, you may find this interesting, is not caring for your elderly parents when they're feeble. That's one way of dishonoring your parents. I'm so thankful you let me do that. Honor my father and mother. Okay, sexually immoral. Well, you know all about that. Men who practice homosexuality. Yes, it doesn't mention lesbianism here. Lesbianism is very interesting, by the way. When I was taking classical Greek, we had to translate one poem from Sappho. Sappho was a woman who lived on an island in the Aegean, and she wrote poetry about all her poetry is about the beautiful women that lived on the island, how sensual they are and how beautiful they are and so forth. Do you know what the name of the island was on which she lived in the Aegean? It's still called this to this day. The name of the island where Sappho lived, what is it, sweetheart? Lesbos. Homosexuality, I'm often asked about that in today's society. Is it a sin? Yes. The practice of homosexuality is a sin. The nature, a person that prefers the same sex rather than the opposite sex, could very well be a result of this sin nature. When Adam and Eve sinned, all of our natures were kinked. They're all twisted. And I've told you before that something that you might wrestle with is something else somebody else wouldn't wrestle with. The deformity of our soul, the corruption of our soul, is different. We're all corrupted, but some people have a greedy nature. It's just they're very greedy, and others are generous, very generous. But you find other areas where they all of us have different weaknesses because of sin. Sin has corrupted our nature. So I have no problem understanding where sin had corrupted me with a heterosexual nature and the temptation with women, and yet this guy has a homosexual tendency and his temptation is with other men. But because I'm a heterosexual, that's not particularly a sin unless I act on it, chasing women. Now he may have a His sin nature may be such that he's got this kink over here of being a homosexual. But if he acts on it, it's a sin. It's the behavior. Now, if he wants, so we have to be very careful here. He has an orientation that is kinked, no question about it. But he's responsible for how he behaves with it. Just like I'm a heterosexual, but I have to be held accountable for how I behave with it. Now, some people, I think, are heterosexual, but they have a real kink. I heard a lecture recently by a psychiatrist who said that the average philanderer, you know, the man that goes from woman to woman, that the average immoral man will have as many as 5 immoral relationships over the course of a year, an average. 5 affairs with women in a year. He said JFK, when he was president, can be demonstrated and counted that in a period of 33 months, he had 33 affairs. And some of these were multiple. He said this is mental illness to a great degree. He may have had the urge to have these relationships, but when he committed them, that's where the sin occurred. You have to fight it. So when a person that has a homosexual orientation, which they're still not sure whether this is something that's been genetically formed or socially formed, what I have noticed is that you have a kind of melancholy person with a smothering, dominating mother and a passive or absent father. You've got the classic pattern for a gay guy. A man's involvement in the life of his sons is key for their identity. They learn from the father how to treat a woman. They identify with him so that they, like a man, focuses on a woman rather than, if he identifies with her, a woman thinks of a man, right? So if the boy gets his identity from the woman, which way is he going to look? Like she does. So it's very key that from a sociological perspective. But I think that homosexuality is more than just a sin. It is a perversion. Paul says in Romans 1 that it is contrary to nature, which is true. Two guys cannot conceive and have a child. Two women cannot conceive and have a child by themselves. In our society, science is helping this perversion to be advanced. And what we're going to reap by children raised by homosexual couples, I hate to think what's going to come out of that. Our society has given the scientific evidence one blind eye. The scientific evidence is quite clear about homosexuality and transgenderism. But we don't want to... Science is quite clear that there's a radical difference between how women act and how men act. One social scientist that I read recently said that she studied children on the playground for over a year. She said she discovered a number of things. Number one, boys fight out there. They're aggressive. And they beat up on one another. But after the fight is over, it's over, and they're friends. That's not the case with women. Once the fight begins, the fight continues. Number two. Have you seen that? Another thing she noticed, that men are physically aggressive. How do women fight? Verbally. Slander. Rumors. Lies. All sorts of things like that.
It took
an advanced degree to discover that. That's the way science is. Women, and so our society, once we think that, what we did was we pushed, now I'm going to go way out here on the limb, and I may need to give a forwarding address here, but once we pushed for equality between men and women, I believe in spiritual equality, that we're equal before God, but once we thought equality so that a woman can do the job as a man, and a man can do the job. You know, they're equal becomes interchangeable. Once we said equality, we implied interchangeability. Once we implied interchangeability, homosexuality is natural. If a woman is just as good as a man and man just as good as a woman, then two women or two men doesn't make a difference. It's just an extension of that. So, should women have the right to vote? Why not? Can a woman have the ability to be a CEO or a general in the army? Does she have the ability? Yeah. But she will process information more differently than men do. And it's awfully hard when you have a female commander. There are certain things you can say to a man commander that you disagree with, that if you said to a woman commander, you're in trouble. The problem is the battleground is not the same. Men with men playing tennis, a man comes and with a woman, she can play tennis, but he's got to play badminton. So he has to fight with a woman with one arm tied behind his back. But this is where our society is going. What our society is going against is any boundaries whatsoever. Yeah. Yeah. I heard what's her name? Germaine Greer. Remember her? Germaine Greer, a feminist. She's getting a lot of flack. She said, "I don't care what you say. A transgender woman is not a woman, period." Good for you. About time she said something intelligent. And you heard about this guy that said he was a woman, then entered the wrestling matches and beat all the women. I mean, this is just nonsense.
Always came in second to him because he was a guy. But his mother said he wanted to.
I'm thinking of that phrase that Paul writes in Romans 1, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And what we're doing is we're showing that while we think science is king and it can explain everything, we are willing to distort science for our own political agendas. Women are different. And as they say in France, vive la différence. Anyway, that's what you got here. And enslavers, I don't know why anyone in the South didn't see this before the Civil War. Enslavers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound or healthy biblical doctrine. That's the purpose. That's why the law is given. The law is to say that is a sin. If you do it, it's punished. By the way, the law doesn't help you live the Christian life. There's nothing in the law to provide you with the power to overcome sin. Let's look at the mistake number 4 and then we'll finish. These false teachers teach doctrine contrary to Paul's gospel, the gospel Paul preaches. He says, in accordance with the glorious gospel of the blessed God with which I have been entrusted. He calls this earlier sound doctrine. The word sound doctrine means healthy doctrine. Biblical doctrine is to help you become a spiritually healthy person. Any corruption of it is like a corruption of your diet, eating bad food, junk food, or at worst, even poison. Biblical doctrine is healthy. Unbiblical doctrine or distortions of biblical doctrine are of various degrees of unhealthy food. So the standard by which we judge everything is the gospel. That is the standard. And next Sunday will be the 1 year anniversary for me. Did you know that? I came September 1st was my first Sunday here. And so next Sunday will be 1 year. So I thought I would preach a gospel sermon next Sunday. And we'll have, Red, can I enlist you to be one of the people up on stage like I did? No. And I'll try to make sure you're not laughed at either. Okay. I've got a concept in my head. I'm always trying to think, there's an old Arab saying that he is the best teacher who converts the ear into an eye. So I like to think in terms of object lessons. And I've used one or two with you, haven't I? Well, I'm thinking of another object lesson on how to explain the gospel. And I need some poster boards, and I'll have to explain this to, by the way, if when I explain this to Ruth Ann when I get home and she doesn't like it, we'll do Matthew 4.